From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. On today's program, senior water scientist James Famuyiwa of NASA marks Earth Day with a look at climate change and the severe drought affecting California and the West. And actor Isaiah Washington tells us how his personal experiences informed his decision to produce and star in a new film called Blackbird. But first, the U.S. is moving to normalize relations with Cuba. President Obama broke the diplomatic barrier by meeting with Raul Castro in Panama earlier this month. And the White House is seeking to end Cuba's designation as a state sponsor of terrorism. Later in this program, we'll be joined by Catherine Murphy, a filmmaker and adjunct professor at the NYU Center for Global Affairs, to talk about the political and diplomatic hurdles ahead for the U.S. First, though, we start our conversation on Cuba with journalist Anne-Louise Bardock. The Columbia Journalism Review describes her as the go-to journalist on all things Cuban and Miami, and she's here to talk about the complex history and future of race relations in Cuba. Good to have you on the program.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Let me start by asking what your sense is of all of this activity that's happening around Cuba, some of it obviously from the White House.
Well, it's a sea change. Mm-hmm. It's almost as big as when Kissinger opened Cuba. It's a huge diplomatic coup for President Obama. I mean, 10 previous predecessors in the White House were unable to achieve this. And he's done it. And frankly, he's done a big favor for even Republicans who say they're protesting it, because it takes the hot potato off the table. And in this age, especially with the removal from state-sponsored terrorism, it was kind of ridiculous in the age of ISIS and Islamic terrorist groups and all this going on. The island of Cuba being on that list kind of made it meaningless.
But that's a serious, and that's a big comparison to compare this opening in Cuba to what Kissinger did in China.
I said it's not quite level.
Okay.
I said, but it is. Remember, though, we have been closed to Cuba for 55 years.
Right.
So that's very significant, and it's caused all kinds of problems for us. Many of them were resolved at the summit because it was finally off the table. Obama could go down there, deal with regional issues without having to be berated and beat up about Cuba, Cuba, Cuba. So it's tremendous sea change. Yes, Cuba is not the same as China. The massive economy, but it's a lot closer, and it has always played a very important role in domestic politics and in presidential politics, and will likely do again.
So President Obama was not beat up and berated, to use your phrase, at the summit, but he is being beat up and berated by many in Florida, certainly the Miami Cubans. What's your sense of how politically this will redound to him?
I think he's playing it beautifully, and in fact, the polls in Miami show it's a generational issue. It's older, whiter Cubans who are angry about it. They don't think they got a great deal. Mm-hmm. Pretty much the U.S. we didn't get a great deal in the sense of exchanges, but we got rid of the problem. Mm-hmm. Everybody has Cuba fatigue. On the island, they have Fidel fatigue. Everybody is ready for a new page, and he's achieved that. Mm-hmm. Now, that said, this is not going to change Cuba completely. The primacy of the Cuban Communist Party will remain. Raul Castro has made that very important. The centrality of the Cuban army as the central organ of government will remain. They are not suddenly going to have a multi-party system, that's not going to change. So in some way, people have to tamp down their expectations. That's going to be a long time.
So we're turning the page here. I guess the question is, though, as I intimated at the top of this conversation, whether or not we're turning the page specifically for Afro-Cubans.
Well, that's a really complex, nuanced situation here. Before the revolution, Cuban blacks, it's much more nuanced. It's blacks and mulattoes. They use different language than we use here, comprised one-third of Cuba's population. Today, because of all the white emigration, it is closer to two-thirds. Mm. Now, again, we talk about black and white here. In Cuba, they do not talk about President Obama as being black. He is a mulatto, because his mother and his family were white. In Cuba, it's a far more, somebody is a negro, a mulatto, a mestizo, even amarillo, to discuss the Chinese population. So Or somebody might say mulatto oscuro, a dark mulatto. So it's more nuanced than we have here in the United States, but that is not to say there hasn't always been some very serious race issues mm-hmm. going back to slavery. Now, having said that, we have George Washington as the father of the United States. Well, in Cuba, really the most important person is José Martí, mm-hmm. and a smidgen below that is a man named Antonio Maceo. And Maceo was black, or mulatto, as his mother was mulatto. And there are massive statues of the great Maceo, who led the Cuban army, and the Mambises, and just irreplaceable figure in Cuban history. You can find sculptures to him in Santiago and Havana. His mother, Mariana Grajales, who had 13 children, many of whom were killed in the independence wars, famously said, "I only regret I didn't have another child to give for the freedom of Cuba." Mm-hmm. She is called Mariana Grajales, who was mulatta. She's called the mother of Cuba. So it's a different culture. Mm-hmm. So it's called an Afro-Cuban culture for a good reason. Right. The culture comes out of Spain and out of freed African slaves.
But there is, to your point, though, I think, going to be, continue to be, race and class issues.
That's right.
That are going to have to be navigated inside of Cuba, on the other side of whatever this relationship is going to be.
That is exactly right. Look, before Fidel Castro took power, there were many, many black social clubs. Mm-hmm. They were an important voting class. There were many in the middle class, and of course, many at the very, very bottom. When Fidel Castro took power, he banned all social clubs, mm-hmm. including those black social clubs, which were very vital to black society, because he didn't want groups getting together. There was going to be the Communist Party. Mm-hmm. That was one of the reasons the church had to go. The problem now is that the great migration has been mostly white. Mm-hmm. We did not really see blacks or mulattoes, mestizos, whatever, leaving Cuba till Mariel. So that's like 1980 mm-hmm. and larger numbers. And they just do not have the relatives in the exile community to send the money, and they are really paying for this. You can really see it dramatically when you're in Cuba. You can see somebody, look, at the average wage in Cuba is around $200, $250 a year. Well, if you're getting $250 a month from family in Miami, you are going to have a car, an apartment, a house. If you don't, You may be still living in a bohío or a slum in Havana that's called El Fanguito, which I'm sorry to say is mostly dark-skinned mm-hmm. blacks in Havana. And it's, you know, some of the places don't have plumbing. So it's going to be a problem that needs to be addressed. And I'd be curious to how we move forward and how they're going to do something about it.
Is there a role then that the U.S. can play or should play as we continue to advance this new relationship with Cuba that considers these lower classes of people, citizens in Cuba, and how they're going to fare as U.S. businesses just hightail it to Cuba
right.
and everybody starts making money? Is there some way that we ought to, in our policy, make sure that we have some way of ensuring that everybody benefits from this?
Well, one issue is human rights mm-hmm. and the rights of dissidents. Most Americans are unaware of the fact that most dissidents today are black or mulatto. Mm-hmm. Guillermo Farinas is a black man. Mm-hmm. The several musical groups, some very, very prominent names, I would say most. Very few are just white. Lara Pollón, who ran the Ladies in White, the various women involved there are black or mulatto. And to get support, continued recognition from the U.S. is something that they really would welcome and they're concerned about. A lot of the dissidents in Cuba who are more and more, their ranks are black, are concerned that they're the ones who are going to, fall out of the bottom here. Mm-hmm. And that is an area the State Department for now is saying, look, we're paying attention to you. Mm-hmm. We're meeting you. The other thing is the Cuban Politburo. When Fidel Castro came to power, there was one guy named Juan Almeida, famous comandante. Mm-hmm. And Juan Almeida was the token black man in the Cuban Politburo for years. And then later there's a guy named Esteban Lasso who's still there. They have, to their credit, increased the numbers of minorities and also women. Women were not even there. You didn't find women in the Politburo for years. So, but it's still not representative of what the population is. And that's another area. So it's complicated. The other thing that happened is when the Castro government decided we're going to bring tourism back in the 1990s, because, you know, we're desperate. Mm-hmm. The Russians have left us. We don't have a patron. We need to do tourism. Well, that almost everybody who worked in tourism was white. Mm-hmm. And that became a big race issue in the 90s that became amplified, and people protested about it. But and even when they hired blacks in tourism facilities, they were invariably light-skinned. And that has been an issue that they've made some progress on. Initially, no Cubans were allowed in the hotels.
Right.
Now they are. But it needs a lot of work. Fidel Castro, you know, came out of Oriente, which is where, you know, the great former slave populations were, but his followers were primarily white, and he had a trusted group. And with the exception of Juan Almeida, it was pretty tokenism.
Yeah. A lot of things to keep our eye on as this relationship continues to develop. Thank you for coming on in, Louise.
You bet.
Appreciate your insights.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. We continue now with our conversation about the island nation of Cuba. Please be joined by Catherine Murphy, the founder and director of the Literacy Project and director of the 2012 documentary, Maestra, which told the story of the 1961 Cuban literacy campaign. What's your sense of all of this activity about and around the U.S.-Cuba relationship?
Well, it's very exciting. Mm-hmm. It's a very exciting time. I think it's an exciting and hopeful time for those of us who have been involved in the U.S.-Cuba realm and trying to build constructive bridges between the two countries. Hearing both presidents make the historic announcement on December 17th, 2014, that steps would be taken to reestablish normal diplomatic relations was a huge and wonderful step forward. I've heard many people on both sides of the Florida Strait say they didn't expect to see this moment in their lives. So, you know, there's a long road ahead, but this is a new day. It's a new chapter.
A two-part question, which I try not to do, but I think there's some nuance here you can play with. Why do you think it took so long? And what does it say about us that it took so long?
Good question. Good questions. You know, the U.S. owned a lot of the property on the island of Cuba up until 1959. Between 1902 and 1959, the U.S. had a major role in Cuba. Mm-hmm. Cuba's economy and politics was a major property holder, owned many key industries, actually. So when the Cuban Revolution happened on January 1st, 1959, came to power January 1st, 1959, it meant, and they really started a deep restructuring process of the power structure on the island and property holdings. They nationalized U.S. properties. They carried out an extensive land reform act in which over 100,000 landless farmers, sharecroppers, tenant farmers, and landless peasants got property titles overnight. Well, that was expropriated from large landholders and some corporations, and many of those were from the United States. So the U.S. saw its interests as being directly challenged by the new government and started to carry out sanctions against the island from that moment. Mm-hmm. There was also then quite a significant exodus from Cuba to the U.S., also to Madrid, into Mexico City, into Puerto Rico, but mostly to Miami. 100,000 people left the island in the first years, you know, 59, 60, 61. And that was a very powerful group of people who have been the main voice in determining U.S.-Cuba relations ever since. And that's really just starting to change now as the generations start to feel differently, both in Havana, you know, on the island of Cuba, I was going to say in Havana and Miami, and in and also the Cuban and Cuban American opinion is changing, but also the U.S. opinion is changing in general. And I think there's now, you know, a number of studies have shown that public opinion favors normalization of relations.
Clearly, the politics on the island have changed. I mean, the most obvious change is that Fidel Castro is no longer running the government. His brother Raul is, as we all saw from those photos the other day. But how would you describe the change in the political structure on the island?
Yes. Well, Raul Castro took power in 2010 and started to make some pretty significant changes right away. There's a lot more changes that are coming and that need to come, but these were serious departures with policy of the past. So they started to legalize categories for self-employment, or really start to open up the non-state sector. They said they were going to lay off up to 500,000 people from the state sector. So the economy, which had been so heavily dominated by the state, is now really being flexibilized, or, you know, and there are significant reforms and significant opening in the non-state sector again. And politically, you know, this, the tone with which Raul Castro was speaking is such a different tone, that saying, you know, as he said in Panama in the meeting they had with President Obama and President Castro had with the press, he said everything is on the table for discussion. That is new. That's a departure from the past.
For whom has Cuba worked best since 1959? What group of people have most benefited?
Certainly, the revolution was set out to benefit the most marginalized and to benefit the dispossessed, to benefit poor and working Cuban people, to benefit rural people, to benefit Afro-Cubans in particular. So the sectors of the society that were historically marginalized benefit in the early years from the economic changes that were made. You know, healthcare became free, education became free through university, which it still is. So, you know, the historically poor and marginalized benefited the most during the years of economic prosperity in Cuba. Or prosperity is not the right word, but the years that they were moving their model forward.
And then what happened?
Well, they were also highly dependent on a trade relationship with the Soviet Union that was very beneficial to Cuba and allowed them to invest a lot of money in social sectors, in public health, in education, in infrastructure building, and, you know, more than most developing countries are able to do. They really invested in people. And they also were very dependent on the Soviet Union. 57% of the calories eaten on the island were brought in as direct imports from Soviet bloc countries by the late 80s. So when the Soviet Union fell apart, you know, the Berlin Wall fell, the Soviet Union fell apart, Cuba lost its main trading partner, and they were sort of thrown into the sea of global capital with no tools with which how to survive that, and with an economic system geared toward trading in the international socialist economy, which no longer existed. So that started a 20-year process of serious crisis, economic crisis on the island that they called the special period in Cuba. It began, you know, 1989, 90, and 91, and really, you know, continues up till the day of today.
What, speaking of continuing to today, what do you make of the fact that this little tiny island nation, just miles off our border, has survived all these years without us? Almost, I mean, in some ways, thumbing their nose at us that close to our border, and they have survived. What do you make of that?
I think there are many explanations to that, but one is a very strong sense of patriotism, nationalism, a love of independence and sovereignty, which is something they've been fighting for since the colonial period under Spain. They fought for 30 years to be free of Spain, and they had a really incredibly philosophical a philosophically strong independence movement in which they said freedom from colonialism, freedom from Spain, and the abolition of slavery had to go hand in hand. And they had to be building a nation for all, a nation that was free and sovereign, independent, and that was based on principles of social justice. And José Martí fought for that. The black general Antonio Maceo fought for that. That was well laid out from, you know, 1868. So when what we learn here is the Spanish-American War broke out, which from the Cuban perspective really was the U.S. intervention in Cuba's war of independence against Spain, we sort of claimed victory for them. And there was a four-year military occupation and then what they call the birth of the new republic, which was in 1902. But there was an amendment put on that new, on the constitution of the new nation, saying the U.S. could intervene at any time that U.S. interests were threatened. So, you know, over the next, from then to 1959, there was, you know, a multi-party system with a lot of complications, a lot of corruption, a lot of graft, and then there were also were moments of dictatorship. So when the Cuban Revolution took power in 1959, again after several years of fighting against the Batista dictatorship, for many Cubans that was like they had become independent. What they were really envisioning was something that had started almost 100 years before. So they have paid a major price for wanting to be that independent and for wanting to create a different kind of social and economic and political system in the Americas. But they, you know, I started going to Cuba in 1992. I went for the first time in 92. I found that for most Cubans, and there's a diverse range of opinions on the island and ideologies and perspectives, but I found that most Cubans were willing to pay the economic price of the, you know, conflict with the U.S. to gain and keep what they saw as national independence.
Got just a minute to go here. Speaking of paying prices, I suspect at the appropriate time, for many reasons, they will welcome in U.S. business interest. Capitalism has a way of building, but it also has a way of destroying. I'll leave it at that. What should they be worried about when these U.S. multinationals invade the island?
Well, they want trade, they want engagement, they want a respectful, you know, coexistence of neighbors, and they want trade and they need it. But they don't want to lose the gains of the past. And so I think this, how can they keep social inequality under control as much as possible to open up, continue to open up the economy, but really make a major commitment to social justice, social equality, economic and racial equality, that is the challenge of the day.
And finally, what would you guess right quick that Fidel Castro is thinking of all of this?
I would imagine that he's both very proud of his people for having withstood 50 years of all the sacrifices they had to make, that they held out. And Obama has called the U.S. embargo a failed policy. So, you know, looking for a new day without Cuba having to sacrifice its independence or capitulate to a degree that they never wanted to do, I would imagine that that's, that he's very proud of that. And I also know, you know, Raul is pushing forward a lot of changes that Fidel Castro never supported, never wanted to. So I think he's seeing the country moving forward in ways that he maybe didn't want, but also seeing that this new day is dawning while he's still alive.
Catherine Murphy, thanks for your insights.
Thank you.
Good to have you on.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. We celebrated Earth Day earlier this week, but unfortunately, there hasn't been much to celebrate lately about the environment. Climate change continues to make headlines, and here in California, the ongoing water crisis is much more severe than many people realize. If the nation's leading agricultural state dries up, the rest of the nation is sure to feel it. Joining us now to talk about California's drought is Jay Famolietti, a hydrologist at UC Irvine and senior water scientist at NASA's JPL. Professor Famolietti, good to have you on this program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let me jump right in. How severe is this? How bad is it?
It's pretty bad, and like you said, it is worse than people recognize. California has been losing on the order of about 8 trillion gallons of water per year for the last 3 years. You know, our mountains are devoid of snow this year. Mm-hmm. There's very little water left in our reservoirs, and our groundwater is being depleted at a rapid clip, so we're in rough shape.
The reasons for this are?
There's many reasons. One is the natural variability. Driven by things like El Nino and the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, so natural climate variations. But there's a background of climate change and increasing global temperatures, and so this particular drought is actually a combination of a little natural variability and extremely hot temperatures, so that combination makes it really unusual. Mm-hmm. And then there's population growth, too. You know, yeah. If we had 20 million people in California instead of 39, it wouldn't be the issue that it is.
Yeah. How much of this is man-made?
Well, the man-made part of it comes from the population, mm-hmm. right, the large population, and the significant agricultural productivity. So we use a lot of water to produce that food and to provide water for our 39 million people. So in that sense, again, if those things weren't here, it really wouldn't be much of an issue.
Which parts of the state are being most acutely impacted by this?
It's the southern part of the Central Valley of California that's in very rough shape, and in general, the southern half of the state. Mm-hmm. The northern half of the state is wetter. The southern half is drier, and it's in that southern part of the Central Valley where we have lots of agriculture, and they don't have much rain, that they are depleting a tremendous amount of groundwater, so much that the ground is sinking as much as a foot per day in some places. A foot per year.
There you go. As in a day, we'd be.
Wow. That would be a huge
but
sudden.
All jokes aside, though, a foot a year, though, is still extreme.
Yeah, a foot per year is quite significant. Yeah. It causes major problems for, think about it, roads on the surface,
sure.
Our water distribution infrastructure on the surface. That stuff is literally caving in some places.
So to your point now, beyond the impact of the water shortage on food and agriculture and those kinds of things, your point now about its impact with the ground sinking on infrastructure, this sounds like a domino waiting to happen.
It certainly is. And so we need to address it. And the fact is that, you know, in California, in general, we rely on a lot of groundwater. And in a normal year, we would rely on about 33% of our water supply mm-hmm. would come from groundwater. In a drought year like this year, we're up at about 75%. We may go towards 100% as our reservoirs empty out.
So what is the impact of what's happening in California on the rest of the earth, or certainly on the rest of the nation?
Well, we grow a lot of food for mm-hmm. California, for the nation, and really for the world. You know, we are the leading producer of many crops, certainly the nut crops and lots of fruit and vegetables. The middle part of the country really grows the grains, mm-hmm. right? And it's here in California that we grow the produce and the nuts and of course the grapes for wine. And so as we start to run out of water, we'll see rising water prices, rising food prices, and of course that's going to have a ripple effect. Mm-hmm. In the long term, we may see some of this agriculture migrate out of California, maybe move up north. And in fact, that's actually happening. There mm-hmm. actually is some migration of agriculture to northern states like Idaho and to North Dakota, who are, you know, they're getting a little bit warmer and they're getting a little bit longer growing season.
I may be getting a little bit out of your field, but I'm just curious anyway, what your sense is of how this crisis is going to impact the markets.
Yeah.
Because when you start suggesting now that prices are going to be impacted by this, now we're talking about market fluctuations.
That's right. Yeah. No, and you're right. I mean, I'm no expert, but I do think that we will start to see the ripple effect of the rising food prices. The rising food prices, I think, are inevitable. It's really the groundwater that's been a buffer against that.
Right.
Because we've been using that groundwater, we haven't yet fully realized the water shortages in agriculture. I think that that's going to change. I think that there will probably be some restrictions that are necessary so that we don't completely deplete our groundwater supply. Mm-hmm. And that's when I think we'll see the rising prices. You know, water's already rising up in some markets, in some water markets. Farmers are paying $3,000 an acre foot per acre foot. An acre foot of water is an acre covered by a foot of water. And they're paying, you know, as much as $3,000. So I think it's just a matter of time before that ripples through food prices and then across the rest of the economy.
You talked about migration a moment ago. That is to say, some foods that we grow here maybe being grown someplace else.
Yeah.
But what about the idea of certain foods that we grow here just not being grown, period? I think about almonds, for example. And I was just doing some reading about how much water it takes to grow almonds.
Yep.
And so there's now some conversation starting for all of us almond lovers around the country.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I'm one of them.
I'm one of them as well. So two almond lovers who might be in trouble if one of the solutions that is being discussed were ever to become reality, which is that maybe we just don't grow almonds anymore.
Yeah. So there's a couple of issues there. One is that the trees, the orchard crops like trees, and you know, many of them are nut trees, not just almonds, but pistachios and walnuts, and the vineyards, right? They have to be watered year round. And so that's a problem. You can't fallow those crops in the dry years like you could with broccoli. Mm-hmm. Okay, so by planting, and there's a rush. There's an almond rush in the valley to get almond trees in the ground. So that's going to be a problem for the long term. But you know, there's a flip side to it from the farmer's perspective. That is, as water gets more expensive, then it makes sense to plant the higher value crops, of which almonds are one. So, you know, we'll see how it plays out over the long term.
How evenly is the impact of this drought being felt across the state? And when I say evenly now, I'm talking about class.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ah, well, okay. So I think that we are, in fact, I know that we are starting to see inequities arising in access to water. And one of the ways
Surprise.
Yeah, right. Right, and one of the ways that is playing out is with respect to groundwater. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's playing out in other ways. Some of the wealthier communities haven't been asked to cut back as much on their water use, but with respect to groundwater, what we're seeing is that with continued groundwater depletion, the level of the groundwater is dropping. It becomes very expensive, maybe a couple of hundred thousand dollars to drill a deeper well. Mm-hmm. And only the wealthier, farmers, farms, individuals, will be able to afford to dig those deeper wells. That leaves the less fortunate with no access to groundwater. Their wells have run dry and they can't afford to dig a deeper well.
This might be laughable to some who think this could never happen, but I'm one of those who believes, and I've read enough material over the years hosting this program, that into the future, wars, I believe, are going to be fought over who controls access to water around the globe.
Yeah.
How do we make sure that in California and in this country, we don't end up where the politics get to be so tricky around who gets access to water?
Right. Well, you know, I could see smaller skirmishes happening around the state, because there are the haves and the have-nots, and that divide will get greater in the decades and in the centuries to come. Mm-hmm. But one of the things, of course, that we have going for us in California and the United States is that we have strong governance. Mm-hmm. And so it is, you know, we're fortunate in the sense that we live in the same state and we can transfer water from the north to the south. If this were two different countries, if it were Pakistan and India, or two countries like Tunisia and Libya, that might be a different situation.
I just noted that our governor, Jerry Brown, made the list of the time 100 most influential people in the world. So congratulations, Governor Brown. I haven't had a chance to read the piece yet, but I suspect it has to do with his stewardship of the state of California. So politically, how is the governor and the state legislature, to your point, to your view at least, handling this crisis at the moment?
I think that they've been amazing, actually. I mean, we all have our criticisms, but if you think about where our state is in terms of the drought and how severe it is, we're quite fortunate to have Governor Brown at the helm, to have the people that we do on the State Water Resources Control Board, our state secretaries, the governor's cabinet. They are water warriors. So in my opinion, we couldn't be in better hands. Now, we may have issues with one thing or another. Mm-hmm. I think it's time to start addressing the agricultural water use, but in general, we're in very good hands.
What do we say to those companies who have and are in the business of taking this water and then selling it back to us?
Right. So so you're talking about maybe bottled water.
Yeah.
And, right. And, yeah. Well, so it becomes kind of more of a moral, ethical issue at this point, because those companies are within their legal rights mm-hmm. to do that. And that just, I think, underscores how crazy and antiquated our water policy and water rights system is in California and in much of the United States. Much of it was put together, was figured out back in the 1700s, 1800s, before we knew a darn thing about how the water cycle worked and what our population might look like in the year 2015. It no longer works for us. However, these companies are within their rights. They have permits that allow them to take, in the case you're talking about, to take bottled water from a national forest, or to take water directly from a spring in a national forest, bottle it, and sell it back to us.
So we're in a crisis mode at the moment. Are you hopeful about our future?
I'm hopeful that we can manage our way through. We're not going to change things right. like climate change and population growth, but I'm hopeful that we can manage our way through. There's lots of things that we can do, and there's no silver bullet. Mm-hmm. So things like desalination, sewage recycling are going to become more important. Of course, the number one thing that we can do is more conservation and efficiency, mm-hmm. both in agriculture and in the home. I think we're going to see changes in water pricing. There's many, many things that we can do. And I think if we do those things, we will be okay for the decades to come.
Glad to hear that.
Yeah.
Professor Jay Famayetti of UC Irvine and JPL, Jet Propulsion Laboratory, NASA's JPL. Thanks for the insight. Good to have you on.
Thank you.
Good to see you.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Isaiah Washington is a talented actor, producer, and humanitarian, known, of course, for his award-winning work on the ABC drama Grey's Anatomy and the CW hit series The 100. His latest project is a new film called Blackbird, which Washington produced and stars in as the father of a devout Christian teenager struggling with his true identity. It is a performance informed by Washington's own views on parenthood and black identity. We'll hear more about that in a moment, but first, here's a scene from Blackbird.
What are you saying, Dad?
I am saying that you gotta follow your gut, son, and be your own man. Ain't no preacher, your mom or me, can say what it is to be a man. That's between you and God.
How am I supposed to know what God wants? I keep asking and asking, and it's just like...
Well, have you been listening and listening? Or you been doing all the talking?
So I suspect there are any number of things that you could produce and could star in. Why this one?
I'm a father.
Yeah.
I'm a father of three, two beautiful boys and a beautiful daughter. When I saw this piece, I just knew that it was time to have this conversation mm-hmm. in our community. And anyone who knows me, I've always been active in trying to find the most constructive ways mm-hmm. that we can have hard conversations in our community. When I first came out here, as you know, mm-hmm. I came out here with locks and goatees, destined to be an actor to prove to people that what does our hair have to do with our intellect? What does it have to do with our character? It's almost 20 years ago, so a lot mm-hmm. of people forget the beginnings mm-hmm. of what I tried to represent in my own activism. And this time, with this script and Patrick, it's just high time to have this conversation. Yep.
What do you think makes now a propitious time, a good time, the right time to have this conversation?
All of our young boys are dying. That's never good. No matter what their sexual orientation, I can only be an African-American man in this body in this lifetime. That doesn't mean just because I love myself, I have no love or respect for others that do not look like me, or do not walk like me, or speak like me. But I do believe, and one of the reasons why I became an actor is that I wanted to be a servant and be of service. Mm-hmm. So this was my opportunity to be of service to a conversation that just simply needs to be had in mm-hmm. our community. And look at our teenagers, look at our African-American boys that are, as we can say, presumably under attack. And if it is, why are they being attacked? And if they are being attacked, not a matter of black and white, but why? And how can we have a conversation to figure out how we can stop this?
Why do you think that this conversation has been so difficult to have in Black America. It's not that it's easy anywhere per se, but in our community, it's been a tough conversation to have. Why, number one? And then, what is it that you hope that we will see on film that will make that conversation easier to have in the months and years to come?
The first part of that question is extremely good one. And again, you know, when I traveled in this city, in this circle, you want to clear a room in Hollywood, mm-hmm. which I've done, start talking about Africa. Mm-hmm. And I really believe in terms of what I know and understand about various peoples on the continent, there was no term for gay. There was no term for a perverted sexuality. There were men that were with men, there were women that were women. That is how they loved, that is how they moved. If you check the histories, people will argue and debate with it ad nauseum. Somehow, this behavior became perverted to someone via religion or whatever. We have African peoples that is part of a rites of passage, that they walk around with huge wooden phallic symbols. You know, you have it in African ceremonies. So this idea of a perverted sexuality and religiosity over thousands and thousands of years, and there is perversion out there. Mm-hmm. Somehow someone decided that this particular sexual act is perverted and it's going to end us all. But we're still here. We're still living. We're still thriving. Now, the question is, in terms of the African-American community, how do we coexist? How do we have tolerance? And how do we have acceptance for our people who wants to love the way they want to love? That's who we've been. That's the DNA that we share. We are the DNA that care about people that created civilization. And the base word, root word for that is to be civil. So I wanted to put this film out there knowing that we're dealing with a very, very uncivilized climate today on many levels. And maybe, hopefully, when you see the film, it could change your mind and heart and we could start having a public discourse that is civil, because gay people are not going anywhere. Lesbians, gays, transgenders, bisexual, queer, they're not going to change for us. I'm a heterosexual man, so they're not going to change, and I'm not going to change. So why can't we figure out a way to accept one another and have this real conversation in our churches, and particularly our Black church?
You think film is still pregnant with the kind of power to advance those conversations?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Unequivocally.
Yeah.
You know, I had a conversation with one of my mentors years ago, 2 years ago, Melvin Van Peebles, mm-hmm. who I adore, mm-hmm. called him when he was in New York. And I asked him, I said, look, I just can't participate in the system the way it is. I'm just not interested in the movies that, you know, mm-hmm. will offer the opportunities for many people. And I said, how can I go about the business of doing things that I want to do and have ownership? He says, just own it. Just mm-hmm. go out and find people, do the deal, have ownership, and get it done. And that's how I've been looking at things, starting with Russ Parr's The Under Shepherd, mm-hmm. having a very hard conversation, playing a pastor that wasn't supposed to be likable, but I didn't write it, but that's a story mm-hmm. that we need to have. Did very well for TV1. Right after that, Blue Caprice, did very well, a very hard conversation.
Great film, by the way.
Thank you.
Great film.
Thank you, my choice there. And mm-hmm. Now moving into that with Blackbird. You remember the time when Spike would come out with a film? And I remember the time being a wonderful proponent of his legacy, mm-hmm. 3 films in. Mm-hmm. But before that, I can remember not waiting for the next Spike Lee joint, because I knew by the time I got out of that theater, my hair was going to be on fire with a mm-hmm. debate with someone. Mm-hmm. And we were going to be talking about this film all night. And that's how I look at the films that I want to produce, that I want to be a part of, whether I'm acting in them or not. Is that I want it to be like great food on the table. Mm. And then once you're putting this food in your mouths, you're looking at what you're looking at, and you're opening your ears, and you're listening to what is happening here. And you're having a conversation, hopefully. That's what I hope.
I saw a bunch of your tweets over the last few weeks. How concerned are you, your thoughts about the future of Black men? You referenced a couple times this conversation, the perilous nature of these times for Black men in particular. Your thoughts?
My thoughts, again, and I will not fall back from it, is that I think we really need to look at this term Black And I understand it's a hard pill to swallow. Hey, I grew up, you know, with broken screen doors and running through weeds and backyard lots and having sour pickles with peppermint sticks put on them. That's not a culture. That is an experience that I had as a young African-American boy in Houston, Texas, being poor. It's not a culture. Being in a black church, watching people getting happy and falling out, like my mother's an usher. I was an usher, usher in a black church. That's not a culture. And what I'm trying to say is that if we consider this DNA thing, this DNA journey, for those who are interested, and I believe that certain DNAs will not be interested because they're struggling with other DNAs that don't want us to be free. But if we can possibly free ourselves from this term called black, maybe it would challenge the term called white and red and yellow and brown. It may not happen in my lifetime, but if we started now and changed the N-I-G-G-E-R, or N-I-G-G-A word into negus, N-E-G-U-S, now we could, because we know the power of words, right? We know the power of that vibration. We could start having a different kind of conversation as our mind, our bodies, our souls, then it will go about the business of healing our DNA and waking up our DNA to say, well, I'm not black. This suit is black, all right? It's a construct. And that doesn't mean, like I had the ongoing back and forth with DeRay McKeeson, who I really respect and the work he's doing, is I'm not saying let go of our blackness.
Yeah.
That's not what I'm saying. We wherever we walk, wherever we go, we're black people, all right? But the key is what people are we connected to? Because right now, we're still dying in the United States of America, which we have built. Because we are destroying ourselves continually, fighting for something that's black. It's no mainland. We have no peoples and no mainland and no culture outside of our great music. Jazz is not a culture. The black church is not a culture. These are experiences that we've taken from white supremacists to make it good, to make it great, you know? So we got to figure out how we can get back to the mainland.
So how do we self-identify then?
I'm self-identifying through the fact of the means that we have access to a DNA system, African ancestry. That's what I've been talking about ad nauseum. If you go about the business, my goal is to get a resolution put together on Capitol Hill through Congressman Karen Bass that when a baby is born, particularly a person of color or African descent, just when you take that tetanus test or whatever the different tests you take for sickle cell, you also have your DNA. It's an option. You have your DNA tested to find out what peoples that you connect with. I have seen people over and over again that have taken this test, Travis, that something has been awakened in them. I'm not saying this is not going back to Africa.
Sure, I got you. Yeah.
It's just something has awakened. It's like an adopted child. Sure. Once you know who your maternal mother is, your maternal father is, it doesn't mean that you're going to leave this loving situation that you're in, like America. We're having such a great time here, like America. We're being treated so great here in America. We're not dying here in America. Everywhere we go, we're not racially profiled here in America. But since we're having a great time in this fatherland in which we were invited, and we willingly came over here and we happily picked our cotton and we happily got beaten, raped, and killed and pillaged. Hey, man, I'm not saying that, hey, for those people that are happy with that legacy, then you know what? Reaching over the Atlantic, trying to find the peoples in Africa and help strengthen them, then that's not the message for you.
But Blackbird is the movie for you. Is produced by and stars Isaiah Washington. Congratulations, man.
Thank you, man.
Congrats on the project.
And more to come. I'm having a good time.
I'm glad you took Melvin's advice, man, and did this. So thank you for coming on.
Thank you, sir.
You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Tony Marcano is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.